This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
I mean, you really fucked me up. Like, they were like, really calm today, really
sorry,
calm.
Sorry.
Got here in good time, just live around the corner. And
I live a little way away.
I was a little bit late, I've got to admit, but I was so tired. I went to the gym this morning and I got back and... I was badly hungover, and I went back home and I went to sleep for 10 minutes, and you know how it is.
It wasn't 10 minutes.
10 minutes becomes 17 with a snooze, snooze button, snooze alarm. They have them on phones now. anyway, just before we started the show, and yes, it has started.
It started. This is it.
This is the show. Don't try and improve what's already perfect. Just before we start the show, Nat said to me, he said, and remember, Nick, don't swear. And it threw me. I was just like, what? Do you mean it? Have I been swearing too much? But it's
FUBAR.
FUBAR fucked up beyond all recognition. There's what,
the FUBAR, more you think what? About that, the more unpleasant it seems, isn't it?
Absolutely horrific. Absolutely horrific. And also the logo is a sound bar.
Yes.
Which is designed to look like someone's sticking their...
I hadn't noticed that before.
I think it's someone sticking up their middle finger. Like, they don't give an F.
I always think... I know it isn't that, but, like, the Starbucks logo... We've got a cup somewhere.
Starbucks logo is a woman fingering herself.
Well, to me, it feels like it's a mermaid giving two V's up, both barrels.
Oh, no, sorry. Apologies to anyone at Starbucks. It's not... A woman fingering herself. Sorry, I misunderstood. But the capa...
Are you worried about Starbucks
I'm
coming after
about
you?
Starbucks coming after me. Bloody hell. First of all, Mail. Admittedly, they were delivering something to me, so that's slightly different. But and now Starbucks, that's the last thing I need.
Yeah.
If the old capa logo...
Yes.
If you cover up the top bit, it's two women sitting back to back.
Yes.
And if you cover up the top, it looks like a woman with her legs spread open.
Oh.
But it's a torso-less, headless woman.
Sure. Makes it worse, doesn't it?
Not for everyone, but... it's 2018. My name's Nick Helm. And
my name's Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick
and Nat's Fan Club.
And the first rule of Fan Club is
tell your friends about Fan Club.
Tell your friends about Fan Club.
And the second rule of Fan Club is please tell your friends.
For the love of God, tell your friends.
I'll tell you what that was. That was good. Do you know, like, TV shows now, like American shows usually, and they have a big build-up, don't they? They have a pre-credit sequence.
They have a cold open.
Yeah, they have a cold open.
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, that was what we just did.
We did a fucking cold open.
Cold open.
The trouble with this show is that it tends to be another hour and 50 minutes of coldness. So
I mean, it's quite cold at the minute. We've got aircon on.
What are you in here for? What are you,
shush.
She's saying shush, don't do anything, but you are incredibly distracting.
Got Hannah in.
Am I too loud or too quiet?
Oh, I'm too quiet.
Too loud.
Too loud.
Oh, that's.
Did it seem like I was powering?
I think that this is bad radio.
Nat is too loud.
This is bad radio. let's make a pact right
never
now.
Never to do any more bad radio.
Yeah, but let's make a pact right now, Nat. Never to let our audience behind the magician's curtain.
That's right. They don't know.
They don't need to know the mechanics of what's going on in here. They don't need to know that. You know, I'm tired. it's fine. The reason I'm tired is I went to see Paul F. Taylor and Becky Shorrock. Well, Becky, what's her name? They're married.
Becky
Shorrock.
Oh, yes, yeah. But I think professionally.
Professionally. Well, Short and Curly is what they call professionally. Went to see them last night at the Museum of Comedy. And I am exhausted because I laughed so much. It was brilliant.
What time is the show finished now?
It's finished at 8.
Finished at 8, so not that late.
But it was Paul's birthday.
Right, okay.
They were celebrating.
It was his birthday in August, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was August the 3rd, in fact, for anyone that wants to make a note of that. But they've moved house and they didn't organise a party before Edinburgh or after Edinburgh or during Edinburgh. And they've moved house, so Becky decided to make the last... They did, like, a couple of dates in London, and she decided to make the last date his birthday. And it was me and the kid. It was one of our meeting days. And
you should explain who the kid is, I think.
I like it. And normally we go to the cinema... And yesterday, I was just like, "Oh, let's go to this," and so he came out, and he had a nice time, but then he missed his train, so I didn't have to, but I did. I waited with him for the next train to come, which was late. And, I've kind of forgot I'm on radio now. I kind of like petered out. But yeah, anyway, so I had a late night. But anyway, that's not really what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the fact that Short and Curly Show was I think it's the last time they've ever going to perform it.
Okay.
It was fucking incredible.
I loved it. Absolutely incredible.
It was funny. It was clever. And it was just really sort of enjoyable. It was kind of like... We were joking about it. It was just so shambolic, but in that way that Paul is, you know. And I loved it. I was in a double act with Paul a long time ago, so it was difficult watching him and Becky perform. She's just a very funny performer. She's absolutely incredible. And while I was watching her yesterday, I just thought she is absolutely incredible. But she did split up the band.
We were calling
her Yoko the Clown yesterday. but it was just good. She's incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was my favourite bit, but it was a really great bit. Was when he dresses up as the Zoltar machine from Big.
Yes.
And just as he was trying to get on the stage, you know, his turban kept falling off, and there's kind of like they're doing a routine, and then something goes wrong, and I don't obviously know the mechanics of. It's the act, but just the veneer of frustration, you know, the level of frustration that was underneath the veneer of professionalism that they had was so sort of subtle, you know. It wasn't because it's easy to sort of like really big it up and do like panto with it, and it was just really. I just loved everything about it. I thought it was absolutely amazing
because it's shambolic show, but not in the way. It's very structured as well,
isn't it?
It's not
shit. The jokes are great, but it's not like it's sort of. I mean, when I do stuff that's shambolic, a lot of it is genuinely shambolic, but that's sort of deliberate. Do you know what I mean?
Well, people think this, like they describe this show as shambolic, but it's all written, isn't it? It's all...
One of the reasons I'm so tired is I was up all night bloody remembering these lines.
Right, yeah.
That was an aside. But it's hard.
But the thing is,
you know, shambolic comedy or shambolic performance. I mean, this show is shambolic.
Yeah.
But that's what makes it the show.
Yeah.
If it was all neat, then what's the point? And
exactly.
Also, I wouldn't want to do that. And also, my stand-up act, that's shambolic. When I was in the double act with Paul F. Taylor, that was the fucking most shambolic thing ever. fucking hell. I mean, we did that for a month in 2008. Cancelled half of them, watched the Olympics, and then we'd perform in front of large groups of Spanish tourists that didn't speak any English, and they were just like, what the fuck is this? Only in Spanish. And it was an absolute pointless exercise. But
it feels almost, Short and Curly stuff, I think, almost feels like it's very like, it's like a sort of kid show for adults or something.
Yeah.
It's got that real
there wasn't loads of swearing, but I was surprised that there was swearing.
Yeah, exactly. It feels almost like...
It's like Paul said fuck a couple of times.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, that's... what about the children? And then you go, oh, there are no children. But it would be an amazing kid show.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
I love them both so much as people. I was just so happy to see them yesterday. It was such a good show.
My thing about it was the show I did in Edinburgh, like, probably relies on about having two or three little props that I can go, oh, I've got this and I've got that. And every day before Edinburgh, I'd have this thing where I'd go, have I got that? I've got that one and that one. Okay, I'm fine. But then their show, I just imagined there must be so much prep that you'd like the idea that you wouldn't forget one thing, or like everything's a prop, or there's so much to remember that I just find that stressful, just how much you've got to remember.
It made me feel sick just watching them at the end of the night, because it was their last show, so they were just collecting all their stuff, and then we went to the pub. And they were in the pub, and they basically had the corner of the pub blocked out with all of their props. And at the end of the night, they were trying to get an Uber, and two Ubers turned up and refused to take them with all of their stuff. And then the third one, they ended up having to destroy the Zoltar machine, because it was a cardboard box. Yeah, they were just like, okay, well, we can redo that. But you just go, it was when we were a double act, it was always such a ball ache, and it was always so stressful. We used to do a sketch where we would have puns on our we'd get a notepad each and a piece of string that went through the notepad, and we wore it around our necks like a necklace, and then so we'd have a notepad on our chest, and we'd go through the notepad and we would write bad puns for people's names. So it'd be like, I'm Colin Durr, put the lettuce in my hands and I'll shake it dry, you know. And it'd be like, hello, my name's Fat Nav, where's the Pizza Express, it's 20 minutes down the road, you know. And it'd be like that, right? And but when we did them, we would have like a whole stack of names, he'd have half and I'd have half, and we'd rip them off and throw them on the floor. We'd have to do that every fucking time. We'd have to buy a notepad every time. We'd have to buy a string every time, because no one ever brought the string. We'd have to remember all of the names, and we would write them down on the, we were fucking unorganised.
Sort of, but it's funnier, isn't it? If you'd use the same thing, I need to collect all those and make sure the pad's in. I think it's just funnier.
I think, well, the Alcoco Pops joke, which was when I got, I'd go to the, I mean, we mentioned it when he did it before, but when he was on the show, but I'd buy a packet of, like a box of Cocoa Pops and a pint of beer at a cost of like £8, £7, and I didn't have any money. You know, this is when I lost so much weight that my trousers kept falling down, right? Didn't have any money, right?
And so, because you had that string, though. Shame.
Yeah, I had the string to hold my trousers up. But the Alco Pops joke was like, it cost £8 and it lasts 2 seconds, and it's me pouring a pint of beer into a packet of Cocoa Pops. And I go, Alco Pops, I've done this before, makes the beer taste chocolatey. And
if that didn't get a laugh, then what?
We didn't do it that often because we didn't do. It was maybe towards the end of our partnership, but so we didn't do it that many times. But I do remember me kind of like taking apart a Cocoa Pops box and covering it with sticky back plastic and then reassembling it. So it could contain beer, but that never worked. And I think what made the joke funny was that you go, what a waste.
Yeah.
Just what a dickhead. Yeah. What an absolute waste. And you go, and I think that what makes me laugh a lot is when you see something.
The effort.
There's been so much effort that's been put into something that's a throwaway, and it's like the effort is painful.
Yeah,
you just got to get that. Like, we did a joke. We were remembering this yesterday. If anyone is interested, if you type in Helman Taylor on YouTube, we did the Laughing Horse finals. I think it was probably 10 years ago, 2008.
Yeah,
and it's one of my favourite clips of anything that I've done on YouTube, because it was just me and Paul just literally just absolutely fucking a competition up, right? but the thing is, we got like the best. I can't remember much about the night, but we got one of the best responses of the whole evening, and there was a really sweet sort of sad moment where me and Paul were sat on the stairs while they were announcing the winners, and they announced third place, and it wasn't us, and we were like, oh well, we did really well. And then they announced second place, and it still wasn't us, and we're like, we haven't
won.
We haven't won, have we? and we were almost getting up, Joe, and then they announced first place, it wasn't us. And it was just like, we didn't even get placed. That's fucked up. So we had this really great, we had this, one of my favourite jokes that we did was I got an old sort of Mac, you know, like a Macintosh. A Macintosh, but a coat, right? And I drew an eye on the back of it. Mm-hmm. And I attached four plastic apples on the front of it,
yeah.
And we put it on a coat hanger that had, there was two coat hangers that had four oranges attached to it, and I'd hold the coat up and I'd go, iMac, and I'd switch it around and I'd turn it around, so I'd go, iMac, Apple Mac, and then I'd take the coat off, Orange Mobile, and I just really loved it, and it always got like, but it was like an onslaught, you know,
yeah,
but. It was just sort of like there were so many shit jokes. We used to call it our joke graveyard because we'd like I'd do a joke on my solo act and it wouldn't work, and then I'd put it into Helman Taylor and it worked and he did the same and it was just kind of like but
I'd
that
say
joke,
it was a beloved double act though, wasn't it? People loved it.
Well, we literally would turn up to back when we were sort of like when we were all young.
Hmm.
When laughing horse competitions were sort of like a huge deal and it was very stressful, I would do solo stuff and maybe I'd get through a round. Me and Paul didn't care about the double act in a way that was like, let's take this really seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
We just did it for fun. And we got all the way to the final, whereas yes. us as solo acts that we really cared about, I mean, we didn't get anywhere. But the thing about the Orange Mobile joke was that I used to buy four, go around the corner, I used to buy four oranges. Every day, every time we did it, I would have a knitting needle with me. I would stick the needle through the orange and thread some string through it. And my hands would be covered in juice. And I'd be in the corner of the pub that we were just about to perform in. And my hands would be covered in juice. And I'd be tying these bits of string around these oranges. And then I'd be making the coat hangers and then sellotaping the coat hangers together, and it was just like, and then it was right at the end it just occurred to us that, oh, we just buy fake oranges and then it's always good, you know, it doesn't just rot slowly in your hallway at home. But yeah, so I really and I think what I like about that is that you can see that Paul is Paul, it's still Paul, but there's sort of like something that's a bit more professional because Becky's there. Becky's a trained actress.
Mm.
And so she's sort of like...
Yeah, it's still that kind of thing, isn't it?
I don't think we were ever going to get anywhere. You know?
Yeah.
But now it's kind of like it's got like a more rigid structure.
And you did, what, about 2010 maybe? You did like a Christmas show at the Hen and Chickens.
Yeah, 2010 we did a Christmas show, yeah.
And that was, I would say... 100% comedians watching it. It was
oh,
all
was
like,
it?
Well,
did
I remember it being like, well, maybe like, but it always felt like just it was one of those things where everyone went to. It almost felt like office Christmas party.
Right, yeah.
But so I think it was beloved, wasn't it? People loved it.
Did we do it? I think we did it once. I think it was just the one thing. And we did some really, I think we did some fun stuff in there where we got everyone to wear masks of people from Live Aid, but we made and we got everyone to sing at the end, but they weren't masks, they were paper plates and we'd just drawn like Phil Collins on it and stuff, and I really loved it, but I mean I just saw it last night and I just think, yeah, they're amazing. And I said it when they came on the show before Edinburgh, mm-hmm. that I thought they were going to have a good year. They did have a good year. But I think any listeners out there that aren't aware of them, you should definitely start...
Following them on their social medias.
Start following them and seeing them at gigs and stuff, because they're great. So, anyway, what have you been up to?
What haven't I been up to?
Well, haven't you been up to?
Lots, I mean. We went to see the film. We saw the film. Just teasing. Just having a tease. I saw the film Mandy with you.
I saw that. We saw it at the Union Chapel.
Union Chapel.
With Ed Gamble and Brett Goldstein.
We did. On Tuesday evening.
And
it's the new Nicolas Cage film.
From what's the name of the director?
Panos Cosmatos.
Cosmatos, the son of the director of Rambo First Blood Part 2, Cobra and Tombstone. Which were famously... You're allowed to say, yeah, fucked up beyond all recognition. They were ghost directed by him.
Yes. That's, yeah.
So what happened was that, what's his name? George P.
Cosmatos.
Cosmatos. Well, yeah. The story I heard was that Sylvester Stallone wanted to direct Rambo 2.
And the studios were a bit reluctant or...
So he hired George P. Cosmatos. Cosmopos?
Well, I guess it would be a safe pair of hands and has done other things.
Yeah, who's kind of like a very kind of like...
Competent action director.
Workman-like director who does kind of like, you know, standard non-flourishy action movies. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Sylvester Stallone basically got him along and then he directed and the other guy got to have his name on it. Mm-hmm. And then I think he did the same thing with Cobra. And then Stallone did Tango and Cash with... Kurt Russell, which wasn't directed by George P. Cosmatos.
No, I don't know who it was.
Say his name?
Cosmatos. I might be saying it wrong.
Cosmatos. Anyway, so...
Cosmatos.
So later, Kurt Russell was... his passion project was Tombstone.
Yeah.
And Kevin Costner was also making a Wyatt Earp movie at the same time. And Kevin Costner was coming off like the success of Dances with Wolves and Robin Hood.
And also that was very much seen, wasn't it? When Tombstone was coming out, there was this idea that basically this Wyatt Earp movie is going to wipe the floor with it and Tombstone's going to be...
But what happened was Wyatt Earp came out...
Much later, wasn't it?
I think it came out at the beginning... Oh, no, it came out later, didn't it?
Yeah.
So Tombstone came out in, like, March, and everyone watched it, and it was, like, an hour and a half, and it was kind of like, this is the Wyatt Earp movie. And then Wyatt Earp was, like, a three-hour movie that was very slow and not fun and very... And basically everyone, by the time that came out, Tombstone was in Blockbuster.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, I think we'll watch this instead. Yeah. Or we've already seen this film. It was called Tombstone.
I love Tombstone. I think it's great.
I think it's good. It's not like a favourite, and I do like cowboys. But
I really love it.
It's not
really.
And I love Kurt Russell. I just think that he's such a. Anyway, so he's such a difficult character.
I got two guns, one for each of you.
We're talking about Tombstone.
That is Tombstone.
Oh. George P. Cosmatos.
I'll be your Huckleberry.
Stop changing subject.
Tombstone.
Oh. So I find Kurt Russell's performance in that really quite unlikable, and he's very quiet in that film.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the reason for that, one of the reasons for that, is basically they had... the production for it was really difficult, and the pre-production for it was really difficult. He had loads of arguments. They wanted to bring in a director to do this. They wanted to recast it. They said basically, Kurt Russell, you can't be in it. You can't do this and that. And he couldn't have the cast that he wanted. And so basically, Kurt Russell said, right, well, he phoned up Sylvester Stallone and he said, who's the name of the guy that directed that you got to direct Rambo First Blood Part 2? And he told him, and he went, right. And so he hired him to do Tombstone. So basically what had happened was Kurt Russell said, right, I'm going to direct this film. So he got the cast around and he said, I'm going to direct this film, but just so that I gain your trust, I'm going to cut 80% of all my lines.
Oh, okay.
So... So there was like people like Sam Elliott and Val Kilmer, and they were all kind of like, okay. So basically, Kurt Russell just cut all of his stuff, and he did everything. It was almost like not a silent performance, but it was It was economically scripted.
Well, like I was saying, my two impressions there from the film Tombstone were both Val Kilmer bits. So they sort of, he gives a real big. It's a huge kind of showy role for Kilmer.
It's a showy role for Kilmer, and then he gets to do kind of like the quiet, brooding cowboy thing. And so what he'd do is they'd film all day, and then he'd stay up all night planning the shots that they were going to do the next day, and then giving them over to the director. And then so it was kind of like it was being ghost directed. But Kurt Russell basically said that he directed Tombstone. And this story came out a couple of years ago because Kurt Russell was doing press for, I don't know what he was doing, but he was having a resurgence, which is weird because I don't think he should have ever gone away. But he did have like a bit of a dry spot in the 2000s. Yeah, yeah. But George P. Cosmatos died a few years ago.
Yeah.
And Kurt Russell said that he didn't want to tell people that he directed Tombstone within his lifetime. But once he'd died, he then decided to absolutely trash his legacy. And you go, oh, right, okay. I can't. It's a bit of a weird way of going about it. Anyway, his son directed the movie Mandy.
Yes, and previous to that, he did a film called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is like a sort of very quiet, brooding, quite slow sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
And there's elements of that.
I haven't seen that.
Okay.
It's been on my Amazon list for a long time.
If anyone wants to get you.
If anyone wants to... No, it's not a public list.
No.
What did you think of Mandy? hang on. Three. We'll do one word review in after three. Okay. Hang on.
Oh, I don't know what my word is.
One, two, three, two, one. Yeah, unusual.
I liked it. So, like, it's. I didn't love it. I liked lots of things about it. I think it was trying to have its cake and eat it a bit. It's a very much like, there's a lot of these at the minute where they're kind of like throwback, almost 80s B-movie, video era B-movie people trying to recreate that in a film. And it feels like another one of them. But it also has this thing, I think, like Beyond the Black Rainbow, where it's like a genre film that also wants to be, it's quite arty and
it's
wants
an
to be...
It's an art house B-movie.
Yeah. And I'm not sure, as a thing... I like that idea so much. And the idea that it's also 2 hours, so it gets to be quite pondering, whereas it also wants to be like an 80-minute, like, straight-through, mad...
Gore fest.
Yeah.
But also... no, I forgot what I was going to say. I interrupted you, and I've paid the penalty.
But there's lots of good things about it. I really like the soundtrack.
Oh, that was it. It's very slow and ponderous, mm-hmm. and then halfway through, they start throwing out these one-liners, and you go,
"Yes,"
which are from. It was almost like someone else had written it, and someone else directed it, because it was kind of like the tone of the one-liners was kind of like, "Oh, he's telling jokes now."
Yeah,
but it was
that character hadn't really been established as someone that would have those kind of.
I
think you're meant to assume that he's something like an alcoholic who's sober. For most of the film, and maybe this relationship he's in has sort of sorted him out, and then when it all goes wrong, he becomes sort of reverts back to being this sort of wild character.
Sure,
but that's you're sort of inferring that yourself, aren't you?
I really enjoyed a lot of it.
Me too.
Like when I was enjoying it, I thought it was brilliant, mm-hmm. and when I wasn't, I found it boring. Mm. What I should say beforehand was that this is one of the films, and maybe this is the most excited about a film I've been in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
I can't even remember the last time I was this excited about seeing a film. And I wasn't like overly going for it. And I don't think I built it up too much in my head. I was just kind of like, throughout the day, I was kind of like, oh God, I've got so much work to do.
Yeah.
And then every so often I'd go, oh, I'm going to go see Mandy tonight.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like really... And I used to hate Nicolas Cage as well until I went on Space Mountain 11 times in a row, got whiplash, had to go on Tramadol, and ended up watching a load of Nicolas Cage films, which was absolutely fantastic. So since then, that was kind of like, oh, right, I do like Nicolas Cage. And I really loved the fact that... he's kind of like, and this is the first time I've ever heard, this is the first time I've kind of like been aware that people, when they were watching it, going, oh man, he went full Cage.
Yes,
do you know what I mean? It was just it's kind of like he's made so many shit straight to video or straight to TV movies over the last, 10 years? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you kind of, not that you've given up on him, but it's great to see him have the opportunity to kind of like... just really do something mental that only really Nicolas Cage could do.
Whereas I've always really liked Nicolas Cage, and I think those movies that he's done in the last 10 years are almost ones I haven't really seen because I've worried that they're too like almost too silly.
What I would say is that I loved Raising Arizona. I loved early Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, me too.
And then I loved The Rock.
Yeah.
And then he annoyed me in Face Off at the beginning. But Face Off is not a film that has aged well.
No.
Not like Con Air. And I love him in Con Air. We talked about Con Air last week, yeah. But I mean, I love him in Con Air. But
Face Off was the film that when Face Off came out, that was the film I was so excited about it. And then when I watched it, I remember being a bit like, oh, I wanted to like Face Off much more.
I told myself that I loved it, and it got 5 stars in Empire and all of that. And I was kind of like, the bit when the family run their hands over each other's faces, and that's their thing. It's kind of like, is that what you've developed between you, John Travolta and Nicolas Cage? You go, we need to have a thing that we both do when we swap faces. You go, oh yeah, you just go up to your family members and you get their hands and you rub it all over the other person's face. It's just, you go, that's fucking ridiculous. When she goes over to the little kid at the end, spoiler alert.
Spoiler!
Nice. And when she goes over to the little kid at the end and she fucking rubs his face and puts her hand, I suppose it's because it's about faces.
Sure.
But it's more like feces. That's my review. So I went away from Nicolas Cage. Mm-hmm. National Treasure can fuck right off. National Treasure 2 can even further off. But I like stuff like Vampire's Kiss. I mean, I thought that was incredible. I think that's like a really great and people hate that film. But
I didn't know people hated it. I thought people really like it.
People think that it's a bad Nicolas Cage film. They think it's a bad performance. No. That is an amazing performance.
That's one of the good movies.
That is what Nicolas Cage, you know, if Nicolas Cage came along and he did that performance now, you'd go, that's absolutely, and I think it's a really great precursor to American Psycho, the film and the book, because it's kind of about a guy that thinks he's a vampire and he goes around being a vampire, even though he's not a vampire. Yeah. But he's like a city guy, an 80s kind of. But it was actually filmed when American Psycho is set.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in that era. It's not like American Psycho is set in the 80s. It's like it was the 80s when they made that film. I really like it. Mandy, I just thought, and it's also a tick list of everything that I love. It was like
I think that's it.
A heavy metal revenge movie starring Nicolas Cage that's got like amazing, but it was never not beautiful to look at.
Yes.
This was Ed's opinion, I just thought it got gory, but it never really went gory enough for me.
No, it didn't. It was never that extreme. There's lots of odd things that I really like about it. It has things like a mad villain played by Linus Roach, who is son of Ken Barlow from Coronation Street.
Is he the on-screen son?
No, he's in real life.
In real life?
Yeah,
he's
real
Ken
life.
Barlow's son.
The actor William Roach.
But he
son,
also played, I spent the whole time going through it, I spent the whole time watching it, trying to work out where I'd seen him before, and he's Batman's dad from Batman Begins, and he gets his cock out, doesn't he?
So, he does.
And not only, I wanted to talk to you
not
about
in Batman
the fact
Begins.
That, not in Batman Begins, in Mandy. So that was food for thought.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. if you like watching films with male genitalia in it, go and see Mandy. But I think the way that I best summed it up for myself was that I enjoyed it a lot more when I wasn't watching it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Like, it's like an experience. You've watched it and gone, oh, that's fun.
Yeah. Next day, it was like, I was like, I thought about it all day and I was just thinking, I like that. But I didn't, when I was watching it, I was bored. Until I wasn't bored, and then I loved it. And Bill Duke was in it.
Yes.
And I always love seeing Bill Duke. Bill Duke is from Predator and Commando, and he famously, or not famously, directed Sister. he's like this real tough guy. He's the bald black guy in Predator who's always shaving, and he's like this tough macho guy. And he's also in Commando, and he goes toe to toe with Arnie, and you genuinely think he could probably win.
Yeah.
Like but he's not huge, but he's like really fucking tough, and he's mean looking.
He's got an aura of meanness and a tough,
absolute tough bastard. And you just go fucking hell. And he directed Sister Act 2: Back in the Habit. And that's my favourite. One of my favourite Predator facts is that you got two governors, and
maybe they'll get him to direct the next Predator film, but with Whoopi Goldberg. And
I don't think they should make any Predator films. I think they should stop. I think they should have
stopped.
I think they should have stopped at one. That first film is such a magnificent, perfect. That's for me, that's a perfect film. That's on my list of that is a flawless film. I think it's everything about it: the tone, the cast, the economic storytelling, and character development. It's just all great. Everything's there in the film, and not just that none of the sequels, because Predator 2 is okay, but not that none of the sequels are as good. None of the sequels in the same conversation. It's just like, it's just that film. Anyway, Mandy, I liked it.
Definitely, I think people should see it, right? Because it feels like, I think what the thing I came from it was, I really like that idea of those sort of 80s B-movie revisited films. But actually, I think watching them, I think I just like the originals, and I don't want to... I don't know if I want to see people trying to remake those films. But there's enough of them that I like them. I like watching old ones.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know if we need to see ones that.
No, I think it was great. But if it was like a cocaine fueled non-stop roller coaster, which is what
it sort of advertises it itself as,
which
yeah.
is what it's advertising, and I think it's what it thinks it is. Mm. Then you go, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with making stuff like that, but make it. Don't just kind of like leave a lot of it for us to kind of retrospectively go. Mm. Oh,
I think I like both versions of the film. I like the slow, ponderous one. If it was like that all the way through, you'd be like, "That was good."
Absolutely. What's the film that I sort of compared
it to? We were talking about that Brawl on Cell Block 99, weren't we? And that's a similar thing, which like an 80s.
Yeah, I think I might have preferred that more when the gore kicks in that. Mm. And I'm not like a gore hound, but I mean that's what those films are.
Yeah.
When the gore kicks in that, it's kind of worth the wait.
Yeah.
But with this, it was just kind of like, oh, you sort of both, cut someone's head
off.
Yeah,
they're both examples of that kind of films that splice together. One that's more of a kind of a sort of more thoughtful film.
Sure.
And another one which is sort of all out gore action.
What?
That it's marrying them together that feels like I almost would have preferred. I feel like when you buy into the story of something, it almost feels slightly cheated to then have a thing where it's like, don't actually care about any of these characters.
Sure.
It's that. I think it's like, it sort of builds up this idea of like, you're sort of invested in it. And then the second half is kind of, no, it's all mad and silly.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, I think it shows you how good something like a film like From Dusk Till Dawn is, which actually works both ways.
Yeah, sure.
Where I think that's a good example of something that when that has the switch, it's still, the first half is still B-movie enough that you kind of, it's fine. And you're not terribly invested, whereas this almost feels like you're basically watching a recreation of some sort of real life scenario, which then turns into something which is so, like, you know, broad and mad and and I feel like it almost. I think I always feel a bit cheated more than I feel like satisfied by that.
I didn't feel it that jarring, but I do know what you mean. Like the slow pace. I mean, I saw a Ghost Story recently. Casey Affleck film.
I haven't seen that.
I think that film is incredible.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought it was, like, for me, it was so slow, so beautiful, like, no pun intended, but it was haunting, right? And that's obviously
good
the
one.
Tone. That's obviously the tone that they were going for.
Nice one.
But I just loved it. Fuck off. Right? I don't know if you know, but you're saying that into the actual microphone.
Oh, shit.
For listeners at home, me and Nat famously don't get on.
No.
Right? When we're doing the radio show,
he's
taunting me every single time.
Flicking V's.
And this time he's gone one step too far by actually whispering it into the fucking microphone. It's very fucking unprofessional, Metcalf.
I think this is unprofessional because you've gone off script.
Oh, right.
No, let's get back
there.
On this.
It's on page 32.
Okay.
Ghost Story is absolutely fucking incredible. It's such a slow. Team Nat. Fuck you, Nat.
Well, she would be Team Nat because she's
surrounded
also a Nat.
Surrounded by gnats.
Yes.
And not the buzzing, biting kind. Although there's plenty of backbiting.
Yes.
I don't know. Don't know what the phrase I'm going for there is.
Sorry, a ghost story.
The tone of Mandy. When I was watching Mandy, it was so slow, and I was trying to remember the last film that I watched that was that slow, and it was a ghost story, and I loved a ghost story. And so I think you're right. If it was all like that, it was fine. But then, and if it was all the other thing, but
yes,
it's
that's
great.
What I think. But watch it because it's well worth watching, and there's lots of good stuff in it.
It's brilliant. And do you know what? We're in the minority.
Yeah,
everyone has gone apeshit crazy for it, and I just think that, you know, maybe I was just tired. I'm gonna play a song. Mm.
It makes me shiver to the bone. It shakes me, babe. Just a heartache that got caught in my eye. And you know I'll never cry. I'll never cry. Sometimes I drink more than I need, until the TV's dead and gone. I may be lonely, but I'm never alone. And the night may pass me by, but I never cry. Take away my eyes. Sometimes I'd rather be blind. Break a heart of stone. Open it up, but don't you leave it alone, 'cause that's all I got.
Lovely stuff. Lovely stuff there from Alice Cooper. Not what you expect.
No, I'm saying that.
No, part of the education of the masses here. Well, I say masses. How many listeners?
How many listeners now?
Seven listeners. Fantastic. seven people that... I love that song so much. I was just hearing that. That's my drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning song. Well, I'll or it'll be my... hungover in the morning song.
Sure.
When I wake up. Or it'll be like my jogging song.
Do you imagine people looking at
I listen to it a lot. Yeah. I love that song. Do I imagine
Do you imagine you're sort of... That it's part of, like, that the world can see you as if you're in a musical?
No. No, I don't do that. No, it's, I'm obviously an absolute fucking state. And I would not like to think that anyone would see me.
No.
I wanted to just ask you one thing recently about comic books.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing as we were talking about Batman's dad's dick.
No, it's Batman's dick.
Batman's, we were just talking about Batman's dad's dick.
Oh, yes, we were.
So I wanted to say, yeah, so Batman in the comic books got his dick out, didn't he recently?
He did, yeah, that happened.
That didn't last a long time, though, did it? They retracted them. They retracted his penis right the way back into his body,
they put it in
like a samurai.
They basically decided to do a mature reader's imprint based on their main... like characters, yeah. Which is a fine idea. You can do that. Sure, works well with Batman. But then they did one where part of the reason why they showed it was for mature readers was that Batman comes back from like a night of crime fighting.
And then takes all of his clothes off. In silhouette, really.
Yeah. But then you sort of, you could definitely, it was drawn to be like, because it's for mature readers, you can definitely see an outline of his cock.
Yeah. And so I think that they even do a bit of like moonlight shining on his.
Yeah. You get a bit of a.
Nice cock. Slightly plump, a bit like Ben Affleck's when
out of 10
out of 10 it looked like it was a 7.
That's not bad.
But what is it, Ben Affleck's in Gone Girl, isn't it? There's a shower scene in Gone Girl where Ben Affleck is just in the shower and for some reason you just see his cock.
Oh, I haven't seen Gone Girl.
Oh, mate, if you want to see Ben Affleck's cock,
yeah,
you can just see sort of like, I don't think you can see the end of his cock.
But you can see the beginning.
Nice plump cock there, Ben.
Out of 10?
7.
So this is what
you can see why
to.
It's almost like they based comic book Batman's cock on movie Batman's cock.
And speaking of Batman,
I don't know how to do this. It's line. It's the one that's line hold, right? So we're now going to go over live to our first guest of the morning. Rob, it's the afternoon. It's Robin Ince. Hello.
Hello, do you know what? That's lovely. I was told immediately to your producer away.
Say that again. We're going to have to phone you back.
Hang on.
This happened last week with Henry Widdicombe.
Hang on.
It's got to be what do I have to do? Are you going to phone him back?
Hang on. Shall we?
Tell me what you're doing. Tell me what you're doing.
We're going to get Robin back on the phone in a second.
We're going to get Robin back. Oh, Batman and Robin.
That's what I was doing.
Oh, God. From
Batman to...
Honestly, I thought we were talking about Batman's cock.
Exactly.
And then you said, talking of, and I was just like, well, of course he's not Batman.
No, but he's Robin.
Well, we all know Robin.
Well.
Hello, are you there?
Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, we're there.
What are you saying, Robin?
Well, no, I was just saying that I was told just before I came on, they said, just remember, it's an uncensored station. The very first couplet of words I heard was plump cock. Well done, everyone.
Well, that's it. That's what we're talking about. And yet, that's what you're here to talk about as well, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. Well, as you know, Nathaniel, from the comic shop times, where I accidentally bought my 10-year-old son, Mark Miller's The Ultimate, I left it for him. And when I rang him up to see if he'd enjoyed it, he just went, Dad, it was not appropriate. And I feel that in many ways, that tagline will fit with this show as well.
Do you think of Ben Affleck's cock? Out of 10.
I've never seen it.
You've got to see Gone Girl.
Where am I going to find this?
It's on Gone Girl, mate.
Gone Girl.
There's a shower scene towards the end of Gone Girl. It's probably within the last 5 minutes of... I mean, they were home straight. They didn't need to do it. And in the last five, ten minutes of the film... No, they don't ruin it. It makes it weirdly better.
Was it like... Is it an M. Night Shyamalan one?
There was a twist at the end.
There was.
Of his cock.
It's one of those bits, isn't it, that as a film, a great director, when a film starts to flag, you know, David Lean would often say, oh, do you know what, the last 5 minutes of Lawrence of Arabia, I don't know if it's working. Peter, could you pop it out? Just on a camel, just rest it gently on the top of the camel. Just
tighten the knot.
Drape it over a camel's hump.
Do you know what? I love having conversations like this when I'm stood in the middle of Nottingham Railway Station.
Oh, pick that name up off the ground. Someone's in Nottingham.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I was in North Allerton yesterday as well. Go on.
I
can keep the momentum going.
Oh, there you go. We've got a picture of Ben Affleck's cock right here. Just the beginning of it, really. Or is that the end? Is that an actual bell end there? Is that a bell end that you're showing us?
We'd have to.
Fantastic.
So, Robin.
so you've written a book about philosophy. Fill your boots.
That's one of my favourite. This is like the antithesis of the segue that I had on Channel 5 the other day, where I was on a show with a bloke who's on Putin's assassination list, right? And he told this tragic story about the fact of a friend of his who was murdered. And literally, as he finished saying that, it just went through. Now, Robin, you've got a book out. Well, hang on a minute. Don't make me look too mercenary. Anyway, mate, you've got a book out. That's not about those kind of things, is it?
No, but you have got a book out. And it's called,
yes, I have.
I'm a Joke and So Are You. And I've just got it, and I'm only about 20 pages in, which isn't enough, really. But...
And I haven't...
you haven't read it at all
yet? I haven't read it at all. Although I have seen quite a blitz on Twitter that people are retweeting stuff about it. And, there are some things that I don't like reading, and this is one of the things that I do like the look of. So I'm looking forward to reading
it. Well, hopefully you like... I mean, because I think, you know, between the three of us, we're all kind of, you know, the fascination with comedy... And humanity and both its kind of, you know, absurdity. And I've tried to put in as many, you know, I've interviewed loads and loads of different people in it, and I've made sure that also, you know, not to forget to also mention Ken Dodd and Les Dawson as well. Some of
yes.
the I haven't got the Grumbleweeds in, which is a pity because I genuinely do love the Grumbleweeds. It's one of those things where late night in a hotel room, which is generally my life now, and I think I can't sleep, I know I'll go on YouTube and see what Grumbleweeds footage do. And I watch half-hour interviews filmed backstage somewhere, with them just talking about the process of being the Grumbleweed.
And are the Grumbleweeds...
But that's not what the book's about.
Well, but are the Grumbleweeds still the same Grumbleweeds? Or is it
like
the Sugar Babes now?
It's a fascinating thing. It's Robin Colville, who was the one who did a lot of the impressions and used to do... Yeah,
okay.
So him and... I've forgotten the guy. Him and the other... The guy, the little portly bloke,
yes.
who looked like the kind of thing you'd see in a butcher's window, you know, recommending, you know, oh, that's what a butcher's meant to look like. He had that kind of face.
Like Ben Affleck's cock.
And then... Ben Affleck's cock very often was played by the Grumbleweed.
it's the sort of thing that you'd see in a butcher's window.
So what's happened is he's the only, Robin Colville is the only one who's still going out with Grumbles, but then he met another bloke and he went, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll swap over from being a straight man to being the buffoon, which I think is the only time that's ever happened in a double act where the person who used to be the straight man goes, all right then, I'll play the mad one. None of this is about my book.
But I'd say your book is about psychology and
very,
comedy.
Very badly.
And that would suggest that maybe the fella from the Grumbleweeds feels like he's missing out somehow on the laughs, so wants to be go from being the straight man to being the buffoon.
Oh, it's always the brilliant timing. Why didn't I have the Grumbleweeds in the book? This now feels like I'm just revealing the things that aren't in it.
Mate,
the terrible mistakes that I made as an author.
You've probably got another half a book in you at least.
Well, I'll tell you what. When I initially delivered the book, it was 200,000 words. For its 120,000 words it was meant to be, and the editor was almost in tears and actually said, as if it was a moment in a kind of bibliophile jaws, he went, we're going to need a bigger editor. So it has been quite a... I hope... should I tell you about the book or not?
Yes, no, do.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Tell us about the... right, I haven't even read the back of the dust jacket, so what is the book?
It's basically about the fact that comedians... are absurd human beings, but all human beings are absurd. And if you use the narrative of comedians, you know, because there's always all those things, aren't there, which is everyone loves a documentary that goes, Kenneth Williams made the whole of Britain laugh, but he himself was miserable all
yes.
the time. He was always, always sad.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's first of all, that's not true. There's a friend of mine who was telling me, for instance, they would go, Kenneth Williams wouldn't allow anyone to ever use his toilet. He said, not true. I used his toilet on numerous occasions. It's only people who bored him that he would then go, when they go, can I just go and use your toilet, Ken? Oh, no, I don't let anyone use my toilet. You have to go outside. And then he'd lock the door and pretend not to be in when they came back. But it's using a lot of the kind, you know, why comedians become comedians is a favourite kind of topic, you know.
Yes.
Whether it's the loss of a parent or sometimes there seems to be a higher rate of people who've been adopted, all those kind of things. Starting off with that comedy narrative and then looking at it in each chapter about all human beings. So how the kind of, and about imagination. I talk a lot to Alan Moore and Noel Fielding in one chapter about imagination and that whole kind of thing of, you know, Alan Moore's done a lot of interesting stuff in terms of trying to work out where ideas come from. But as I told him the other day, I said, if you have actually worked out where ideas come from, it means you've solved the secret of consciousness and you'll probably win the Nobel Prize, which wouldn't surprise me with Alan, actually. I think it's time that it went to someone else who was Northampton-based. Francis Crick isn't enough.
And did what made you pick the comedians to talk to? Was there any sort of special requirements that you thought, oh, they'll be good to talk to about that?
Well, nearly all of them. It was just people that I thought, but talking about ideas of anxiety and stuff. So, you know, Sophie Hagen and Felicity Ward were just brilliant for that.
Right.
And then sometimes it would just be someone I was with. So obviously I tour a lot with Josie Long, and so we had lots of, you know, kind of long chats about that. And then having toured with Ricky Gervais, there was, when I was doing the chapter about ethics, I was kind of like, well, there's a lot of stuff he does that I wouldn't do and that I wouldn't feel comfortable doing.
Yes, yeah.
So I kind
in terms of material?
Yeah, it's just things that... I mean, personally, if someone is offended or upset by something I said, I'd like to feel that I was comfortable arguing my corner. I don't want to just go, it's just a joke, mate, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? If sure. someone... I spoke to Barry Crimmins, who the book's actually dedicated to. Sadly, Barry Crimmins died back in February, an amazing American comic who did, you know, fought for so many people who kind of bullied and oppressed him. He was a very powerful human being. And he, when we were chatting about ethics, he said, well, the reason I don't do cancer jokes, he said, I've never come up with one that's so funny that I thought, do you know what, if someone is upset in the audience because it's reminded them of someone they've lost or whatever, I've thought, oh, that's all right, though. Joke's a joke. He just thought, it has to be a really good joke.
Sure.
Really. And in the same way, he talked about just the fact that for him, and he wasn't scared of taking people on. He took AOL to Washington, actually went to court. You know, it's not as if you go, oh, look at that snowflake. He's only taken on an enormous corporation and almost destroying himself in the course of doing it. But he said, you know, words are shrapnel. And he used to like to think very carefully about where he was kind of aiming those words. So yeah. I found that interesting. And Tim Minchin as well thinks very, you know, deeply. When he wrote songs like Come Home Cardinal Pell, you know, he was worried. He was thinking, oh, I'm kind of using an individual here. But then again, this is an incredibly important thing to talk about because this was about institutionalized, you know, abuse in the church and abating that. So, you know, Tim, I think, is very interesting to talk about because, again, he'll take people on, but he thinks very carefully about where he's firing, you know, kind of who he's firing at.
I think you have to, as a comedian.
I think it's a responsibility. Yeah, you've got a responsibility.
I don't buy it just that a joke is a joke and that it doesn't really matter, you know, and I will leave it up to the edit. I don't buy all that.
I'm very conflicted about the whole censorship thing though, because I also do feel that things shouldn't be censored, but I think there is an element of self-censorship where I think you need to take responsibility for what you're saying.
Yes.
Well, I think that's part of free. If you're in a society with free speech,
yes,
then the great thing about that is you should think about it. Because free speech is going, oh, just say anything.
Yes.
Well, then that you're not using it properly because then it loses its, you know, it's like swearing and all of those things. It's more powerful to think, I'm going to make this point now. And I think, there's a bit where sometimes when you're on tour and someone comes up to you and they say, oh, I was feeling really down this week and I've watched your show and I feel really happy and joy. That, I'd much rather have that.
Yes,
you
yeah.
You know, someone... And all of it is different ways of taking risks. This idea of this kind of, and it's been very hijacked by the right as well, this pretense of they're the ones fighting for free speech, but they're fighting very specifically for their favourite free speech.
But going back,
I
was just going to say, going back to Alan Moore, that's something interesting that he was someone who in the 80s didn't like the idea of some of his comics having suggested for mature readers on it and things because he felt that it wouldn't be on a book, so why would it be on a comic? So there was all those kind of... So there's that element of... That you do have this thing now, I guess you've got all the things with, like, trigger warnings, which you can absolutely see why people want to do that. But at the same time, I sometimes worry about, like, in art, is it wrong to tell people? Do you feel you need to warn people? And does it... You don't really have that so much in sort of books or sort of... or more kind of written literature. Doesn't have that thing on the back where it will say, this book contains this, whereas on a movie... You would have like something with a 15 certificate, would have reasons why, may have explicit language in or whatever. So there are all these various different forms of sort of what you could see as censorship. But is censorship different from warning people that there might be content that might be troubling to them?
Yeah, I feel very confused about that. I mean, like in the last show that I did, not the show that I'm touring at the moment, but the one before, I had some stuff that I did about suicide. And... you know, each night I think there's no kind of I'm just start talking about it, and I've actually put quite a lot of that stuff in the book as well because all of that material came out of the fact that I met someone out in Australia and one night she said to me, "You comedian should write more about suicide," and then explain why, and it was because her daughter had killed herself and she thought if it was kind of just out there, not just in kind of medicalised or, you know, removing the taboo. But I remember every night thinking, oh, this is the one bit I have to be, you know, really not fuck this bit up. Really
sure.
Got to be careful.
Sure. I did a song about suicide last year in my tour because I think that it's something that should be talked about. And it wasn't necessarily like a comedy song. It wasn't a comedy song, in fact. I wrote it during a dark patch, and it was the opening to my show, and people would come, like, have sort of not bad reaction. People came up to me and they said that they found it really cathartic, and you go, yeah, well, that's what it's for. And I think that it actually, I think when you come and see my shows, I think you sort of go in sort of knowing what to expect anyway, and I think that it's just a thing that people don't talk about in public, and I just think that it's important to talk about it in public and give people the platform to come up to you afterwards and have a response and to be able to discuss it with you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, but then again, if you're just going on stage making fun of people for killing themselves or whatever, then that's the other end of the spectrum, you know.
I think that's part of what you do, though, Nick, isn't it? Because you still play shows that are kind of, that you can go and see you afterwards and get like a record signed or have a chat with you afterwards. Whereas I guess if you're playing huge arenas and things, you're not going to have that opportunity to talk to the people afterwards.
You don't necessarily have the opportunity to back it up, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I love about touring. I mean, at the moment, the show is just, every night I end up chatting to some people in the interval because I don't go off the stage or I go and sign books or whatever. So there's no bit where I go back to the dressing room. I'm normally on stage before the show's even started because it gets a bit boring in the dressing room. Then afterwards you get in the bar and people come up to you and they say, oh, there was a bit you said there and this chimed with me or this bit made me uncomfortable or whatever it is. And you don't have to immediately say, oh, you're fine. I won't do that anymore. Yeah, you can have a discussion. And
yeah,
you can,
absolutely.
And that's what I love about live. That's why stand-up is best live. And especially in the, you know, fortunately, I've never become hugely successful, which is an absolute relief. Because I can still have those conversations. That's my alibi anyway. I very specifically didn't become an arena comic. I very specifically became a sometimes poorly selling art centre comic just so I could keep that up.
Me too. They've asked me to do arenas. And I say,
oh, yeah,
no,
I had the same lot.
Yeah,
Tony Big Time asked me as well.
Yeah,
Big Time said, please, BDO. And
I said, no,
I said,
thank
I can't.
You.
Yeah, there's a library in Lewisham. Bring that.
Can I ask you a question, Robin?
Yeah.
How much does your book cost?
£16.99.
£16.99.
So you can also, it's hardback, it's all proper and everything.
And that's available in shops?
That's available in shops, yeah. And I hope people, I mean, the nice thing is in the first week, the reaction I've had from a few are what I'd, it was a real struggle. I've done, you know, that bit of kind of, because my, you know, stand-up is rambly nonsense and then trying to go, oh, I need to make this comprehensible to people was very difficult, but apparently it is comprehensible.
There's loads more in this, Robin. Hopefully would you come in one day and have more of a chat with us?
I'd love to, yeah, because it was I'd really like to.
Yeah,
and thanks so much for telling me about, you know, showbiz penis exposure, which I didn't know about
just
before.
I very rarely
get that off any of the other radio stations.
This is a very good chat, actually, because we started with Ben Affleck's penis and Batman's penis, and we've ended with it. It's come full circle. Not the penis. Didn't, I mean, that would be a skill.
A Groundhog Day of genitalia.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to reading your book, and please come into the studio and talk to us again.
I would very much like to. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Goodbye.
See ya.
Cheers. Bye.
Oh, no, hang on. I'm putting the wrong one down. There you go. That was a lovely chat. I did think that we were going to talk a little bit more about Batman's dick, but that's a shame. What's your song, Pearly Spencer?
Days of Pearly Spencer by David McWilliams.
A tenement, a dirty street, walked and worn by shoeless feet, in silence long and so complete, watched by a shivering sun. Old eyes in a small child's face, watching as the shadows race through walls and cracks and leave no trace, and daylight's brightness shone.
The days of Pearly Spencer. Almost run.
Nose pressed hard in frosted glass,
gazing as the swollen mass on concrete fields where grows no grass stumbles blindly on. Iron trees smother the air, but withering they stand and stare through eyes that neither know nor care where the grass is gone.
The days of Pearlie Spencer. The race is almost run.
Pearlie, where's your milk-white skin? What's that stubble on your chin? Buried in the rot-gut gin, you played and lost, not won. You played a house that can't be beat. Now look, your head's bowed in defeat. You walk too far along the street where only rats can run.
Of Pearlie Spencer. The race is almost run. The days of Pearlie Spencer.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back in the studio live.
Live at 105.
Yes. I was going to say good. 5 because it blinds. No. We're joined in the studio now by Charlie Hickson.
Hello there.
You're an absolute legend.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
I'm almost mythological.
You're incredible. Thank you for coming in. What was I going to say? You're not promoting anything now, are you?
Well, not really. I mean, I did have a book out earlier in the year, which we could talk about because it's probably slightly up your street.
What was it?
Well, it's called Gates of Death. It's a fighting fantasy book, a choose-your-own-adventure book, which...
An actual choose-your-own adventure book.
An official fighting fantasy book.
An official one, yes. Well, they were created in the early 80s by Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson.
People
may remember City of Thieves and Death Trap Dungeon.
What was the one?
Wizard of Farlock.
There was a dragon.
No, the Warlock of Fartop Mountain.
Warlock of Fartop Mountain.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Warlock of Fartop Mountain, which was the very first one.
I was going to say, I think it was number one on the side, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And they went on to sell, I think, over 20 million copies. They were absolutely massive in the 80s. Huge cult.
They were computer games. Before computer games.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that killed them off, obviously, was that the whole idea was just nicked and it was much easier to do it as a computer game because you didn't have to use a...
You didn't have to read.
And a rubber and do sums and maths and things.
Yeah. Well, I never used to like that element of it, but I would be fine with it if it was just turned to page 34.
Well, you could always cheat.
Yeah, yeah.
And just say, well, all right, I'm just going to win every battle.
Sure.
Because I just want to explore the story. That's a good thing about me. You can read them and play them any number of different ways.
Was it hard to write or easy?
Which do you think?
Well, my instinct would be that it would be almost impossible. But then... thinking about it, you're kind of like you're writing a bit and then you're coming up with different scenarios that you actually have to get to later.
So it's a complete branching storyline. Yeah, I mean, for those people who don't know what they are, it's kind of like you're in a cave, there's a mad goblin there. Do you want to kick it up the ass?
Sure.
Do you want to hide in the corner or do you want to run screaming? And whichever choice you make, you turn to a different bit of the book.
Kick it up the ass!
Kick it up the ass, yes. Well,
fuck it up the ass! Kick it up the ass!
Always choose the most violent, stupid option available to them. But then it's a branching storyline. So each bit you get to, you've got to have about at least 3 meaningful choices. So the danger is the book just gets bigger and bigger and bigger as it spreads in all directions.
But it also means that you don't have to choose one narrative.
As a reader, no, but
as a writer.
Well, there is a sort of true path that if you made absolutely the right choices and won every battle, you'd get through quite quickly. But you can't steer the reader too much towards them because they have to feel that they're in control and they are up to it to a point. So you have all these other stories and ways of exploring the book, but you do have to end up at the same point at the end.
And do you do it like a flowchart? Will you often get to the same kind of...
You
points.
Do, yeah. I mean, when I started it, I thought, oh, I could do this. I mean, but it's that thing of that everything you do creates another whole mess on top of it. It's
sure,
like
sure.
a sort of Mandelbrot that sort of chaos thing where it just keeps growing every day. So yes, I ended up doing pages and pages of complex flowcharts and diagrams and maps. And
but that's how you'd have to do it, right? Otherwise, it'd never end. Mm.
Well, there is actually now there is an app you can use called Twine, which they use quite a lot in schools, actually,
right,
where you can input it and it does all the sort of branching and stuff for you. It is a really interesting way of rethinking how to tell a story and how to write a book.
But when you went to the publisher and you said, I've got an idea for a book, what, you pitched it as a Choose Your Own Adventure book?
No, they came to me.
Right.
I got to know Ian Livingstone, one of the original creators, over the years, because he also created Games Workshop, Warhammer and all that.
Okay.
He was a massive gamer. He and Steve were the people that first imported Dungeons and Dragons into Europe.
Sure.
They're huge gamers. And he went on, after doing the Fighting Fantasy books, Ian Livingstone went on to be quite a very big wheel, probably one of our biggest noises in the computer industry. He was behind things like Tomb Raider, working for all these companies. He's now a big spokesman for the games. And I met him at a gaming event, because I'm a big, big gaming fan, and I was a big fan of his books and everything else he did. And We got chummy. He quite liked what I did, and I liked what he did. And he said, look, if we ever relaunch these books, would you like to do one? And I said, yeah, it'd be brilliant. So they have relaunched. Scholastic have taken them on and republishing all the original ones and doing some new ones.
Did he give you, like, pointers, or is there, like, a website that you Googled to... Well, Google
there
is where you
Well, as with everything else, there's a huge amount of info online, but there's
on
also...
On how to do it, though?
Well, no... That you sort of have to work out for yourself, and everybody that does it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of help from a fantastic guy called John Green, who's like the sort of keeper of the flame for Fighting Fantasy. He's written books about it, and he's an absolute expert, and he's done a lot of his own. So he helped me on the technical side. But he did say to me, and I was quite chuffed, he said, oh, I couldn't believe after, what is it, it's like 30 years now, that you managed to come up with a couple of things that have not been done before. So I was quite pleased by that.
Oh, what,
I can't tell you what they are. You'd
that's the ultimate compliment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's great.
Doesn't mean it's good. It just means that it's not been done before.
Oh, you've done it like that. That's weird. No one's done it like that before.
Often, though, they would just be, you might turn to a page that's only got like one or two lines where it says you've fallen down a hole and you're there, dead now.
Yeah, you do need to put in a few things where if you make a stupid choice, you are dead.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, some of the books, some of the early ones were criticised that it was way too easy to die.
Oh, right, yeah. Too difficult.
I've tried to sort of give the reader more of a choice that they don't have to go necessarily all the way back to the start.
It's like Nightmare, isn't it? That TV series.
Very much.
90s.
Yeah.
And yeah, I had a very sort of like when I was very young, there was kind of like a big. I think it was about space aliens, and there were these green little things that were on the rocket, and you had to go through it like that. And I don't think that it was possible to even win that. It was like four pages long, and you'd die every single page. Have you ever read that book about the Private Eye? In the 80s, that was investigating a missing kid who was involved in this underground Dungeons and Dragons game.
No.
You've not read that? Oh, God, I wish I knew what... can you look it up?
There was a huge moral panic. There was a huge moral panic to start with Dungeons and Dragons, mm-hmm. because now they hadn't had a game like it before, which is where you play as a character, and it's a role-playing game, and it's about... being that person interacting with the other people more than it is about killing it. And so inevitably, because parents didn't know what this thing was, the children were playing it, there was a huge fear. It's like, oh my God, my child's been possessed. He can no longer tell the difference between reality and fantasy. And there were films made about it and stuff, and it was nonsense.
When I was a kid, there was the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon that was on, and I loved that as a kid, and I remember seeing that there was a Dungeons and Dragons event that was on at the Barbican. I remember begging my mum to take me to it, but only being about four or five, and then turning up, and there's just lots of men with beards and dice, and you go, this isn't what I imagined.
I thought
it was going to be people dressed up as, like, with lances and
Well, that's what people do with are you aware of LARP?
Oh, is that live action role play?
Live action role play, which is where it sort of moved on to, where people go for weeks and dress up as characters and have huge... But I'm actually writing a script sort of vaguely about it, and I've been researching a bit. And there are these huge ones in Europe where thousands of people turn up.
But you get those people.
And they have these huge pitch battles, and they build villages and castles, and they all have their own different sort of races and tribes. It's enormous. Mm-hmm. They're nuts.
Yeah.
And you get those sealed not people. I guess it's an offshoot.
It's the same sort of thing. And in fact, some of them do join together because it's in a sort of vaguely alternative
but
Middle
what
Ages.
If the guys from the British Civil War met a dragon cult? Could be like that as well. Could be a crossover sealed not LARP.
I think it's probably already been done.
I reckon it's been done. If I've just thought of it, yes. It's chances are someone else has thought more about it than I have.
But that whole moral panic thing, it went over into the original Fighting Fantasy books, which kids loved.
Yeah. Sure.
But parents feared it. It's like, isn't a proper book.
The 80s was incredible. That happened with heavy metal as well, with Judas Priest and Twisted Sister.
Anything that your parents didn't know about. It's like today with social media. It's like, well, it's turning our children into monsters and demons.
No.
And this happened with Fighting Fantasy.
You're monitoring your children and what they're doing.
A vicar threatened to chain himself to the railings outside Penguin Books if they didn't destroy all the books. And another mother got in touch and said, you must ban these books. My son levitated after reading them.
Well, that's what... So
you can't buy publicity like that.
So what this book is basically... There was this private eye in...
So is this a real story?
This is a real story. So there was an actual private eye in the 80s. There was a private eye in the 80s who gets called in to do a case. And he's written a book. It's like... But it's written like... you know, like a Sam Spade novel.
Yeah.
You know, so he's kind of like this this really hard-boiled gumshoe who's kind of... And he's written it like it's a film noir. And so he's really embellished his role in all of this. But but it's just this fascinating book where he gets called in to investigate this kid that's been at college. And they've been playing... Dungeons and Dragons in the catacombs underneath the university, and because it's early 80s, there's kind of like lots of, they think it's a gay cult, and so there's all sorts of things. They're these Satanists that pretend to be wizards, and they're all getting up to homosexual activities, and then there's this private eye that's got involved, and he's like coming along, and he's written this book, and it's just absolutely insane, and it's really great, and.
That if you were just a private eye and quite a sort of grubby guy who's just working as a private eye, if you were writing a book about your own exploits, you would automatically become Sam Spade.
Yes.
I am going to find the title of...
See, if this was the BBC, a huge team of researchers would already have the book sitting in front of you.
Well, exactly.
We didn't know it was going to come up. To be fair,
it wasn't in our script.
To be fair to Natalie, but she has spent 10 minutes, and I don't even know if she's typed in Private Eye 80s Dungeons and Dragons.
But this has been like a sort of... like almost like a whole new career, wasn't it? Because you did this and the young James Bond.
Well, I mean, I was offered a new career, God, it's probably about 15 years ago now, as a children's writer by the Ian Fleming estate, who said,
"Yeah,
was I interested?" Well, I'm talking now.
Sorry, we'll I know
get back
you are.
To you
I've just got really excited.
I think we sort of moved on from that.
No, we've got to do it. You can't
all right,
just
go on, then, go on, and then we'll come back.
Put a pin in it.
We'll come back to
it.
James Bond, which is not nearly as exciting.
You'll fucking love this, though. You'll love this.
Go on, then.
You got it? What, just after I've got it? Fucking hell. Fucking hell. It's called...
Dungeon Master.
It's called Dungeon Master, The Disappearance of James Dallas Egbert III. Right, and it's fucking, it's incredible. A Texas private investigator recounts his search for Dallas Egbert, a brilliant student who vanished from the Michigan campus in 1979 while playing a live version of Dungeons and Dragons. And it's literally...
I wonder how much of the book is actually true.
I imagine it's mainly bullshit, but just the way he writes it, it reads like fiction. It reads like the best fiction, but it's his true life accounts of how he saved the day.
Yeah, well, if anyone's ever seen is it called Air Hunters? What's it called? That thing, the daytime thing about detectives finding lost heirlooms.
It's Who Do You Think You Are, but with like a detective element.
Yes, it's like trying to find this money's been left. Let's try and find who it might belong to. Then none of them are like Sam Spade, are they?
No, no.
My dad is a very sort of like a quiet, well-to-do man. He liked painting and gardening. Mm-hmm. And I came home one Christmas to find that he'd been watching Dog the Bounty Hunter. He goes, I love it. He goes, oh, I love this show. It's called Dog the Bounty Hunter. And you go, fucking hell. Good old Tony. So what were we talking about when I was Googling?
Yes, my new career. Yeah, I was offered a new career. The Fleming estate approached me very sort of secretively to say they had this new project that they wanted to revamp.
And aren't they famously very protective of it, aren't they?
They are. Well, all big estates are.
Right.
You know, whether it's Agatha Christie or James Bond or any of them, it's these things are huge.
Yeah, yeah, huge. Yes.
But they approach you.
Yes.
Why you?
Well, actually, because I had written some crime books in the early 90s for adults, and my editor at the time had ended up working for the Fleming Estate, and she knew me. She knew I was a Bond fan. She knew I had boys. But she knew my style. I've always really liked the sort of American hard-boiled writing style, the likes of Dashiell Hammett.
Your loved Dungeon Master.
And actually that sort of very stripped-down, direct style of writing works very well with kids.
Have you ever read any Richard Stark?
Yes, who wrote, what became Point Blank.
There's a bit, I think, in that one that was Point Blank, which is called The Hunter, I think.
Possibly, yes.
There's a great bit in that where it describes his character Parker, and it says, Parker looked like a man who'd been carved out a rock by someone that thought big and liked veins. And I remember going, yeah. And straight away you go, I love Parker. Parker's a cool guy. And it's like page two or something of him walking down the street, and just the description, you go, perfect, perfect. I know exactly who Parker is. And that's what Point Blank is. That's
yeah, well, that's what that writing is. It's finding the shortest, pithiest, most memorable way to describe things, and not pages and pages of flowery nonsense. Mm,
sure.
And they said, you know, was I interested in doing a young James Bond book for kids? And I said, well, of course I am.
And James Bond's actually one of the things we were talking about. Your favourite pop culture icon.
Yes, I was asked to name my favourite pop culture icon. I didn't really know what a pop culture icon
is. It could be anything, really.
What's your favourite thing?
We planned what the show was going to be, 8 months ago, and it's veered so far away from what we initially set out to do. It's basically a chat about anything you want to talk about. And then if we ever get lost, we'll veer into this.
Come back but to the things on the list.
But you,
well, I thought, you know, it's perfect. There's plenty to talk about, yeah. James Bond, isn't
but
there?
It's
we could talk all day.
It's things you're a fan of and that you're enthusiastic about. So anything like that works. So this is perfect, including Dungeons & Dragons and yes.
Well, of course, there's probably not a lot more to say about James Bond that hasn't already been said. But
what's your take on it? What's your hot take on it, Charlie?
Oh, I really like it. It's my favourite pop cultural item. Icon.
Who's your favourite James Bond?
Well, obviously Sean Connery, because I'm of the age where he was James Bond when I went to the cinema to watch a James Bond film.
Roger Moore.
Well, exactly. I was very sniffy about Roger Moore at the time because I probably was slightly growing out of James Bond anyway.
Sure.
And then it was like, well, this isn't the proper, tough, hard James Bond. But actually, looking back, some of his films, the best ones, are actually very, very entertaining. He was a fantastic light comedy.
Yeah.
And as long as you saw it as something sort of separate to the Sean Connery films. Then.
But I also would say that I don't know how many I've actually sat down and watched, not James Bond films in general, but the Roger Moore ones. I mean, Moonraker is a particularly bad one.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are bits that you remember.
But Spy Love Me is great. Man with a Golden Gun.
Man with a Golden Gun is my favourite James Bond film.
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die has its moments.
But I like, do you know what I mean? Him as a persona, the Roger Moore persona, sticks out for me more than any of his films.
Well, that's become the sort of parody Bond films. With the sort of light quips and
But it's nice when a series runs that long that it has to change, doesn't it? And it's interesting now when you're able to look back at it that you go, oh, Live and Let Die is almost like a huge budget blaxploitation movie.
Well, that's what they did, wasn't it? Yeah. They made a blaxploitation film and you go, right, okay, and then Moonraker came two years after Star Wars. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a great thing about each actor has sort of personified the decade in which
exactly
he was there. So Sean Connery was sort of cool, cynical, stylish. Roger Moore was camp, disco.
Sure.
He didn't really take it very seriously. And then Timothy Dalton came in, and then PC came in the 80s. So Timothy Dalton was a bit dull. And then 90s, lad culture, designer culture, you know, all that stuff. Pierce Brosnan's Bond completely personified that.
But also action films changed hugely in the 80s, where it became... And so when you look at License to Kill, which was the first 15 Bond. Yeah. And it was kind of like, it was really violent.
Mm.
And you go, yeah, that's absolutely a result of, you know, Lethal Weapon and Die Hard and, you know, Commando.
But actually, I mean, the thing about Bond is when it's at its best, I mean, Bond always used to be kind of leading and other people would follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the times when it has gone wrong is when it's tried too hard to try and be like other popular films.
Quantum of Solace was rather, like Bourne.
Yeah, I mean, rather than saying, but we are James Bond, we started all this, we're doing it our way. And there'll always be a new generation, particularly if, you know, sort of young teenagers, who want to see that escapist, slightly daft Bond. But so, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens, you know, when Daniel Craig moves on, what the next era is.
James Bond for me always feels like something that I feel like I really ought to be into it more than I am, because it appeals to so much of the things I like. But I almost find that I like those films that are the Bond knockoff movies from the 60s more. I really like all those kind of In Like Flint and
Matt Helm.
Yes, another one of your relatives.
Another great Helm.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was on the back of, well, it was Thunderball, actually, was probably peak Bond. I think in terms of the number of people who went to see it, that is the biggest Bond ever. Something like one in three people in America went to see that.
Wow. The fourth
cinema.
Can you name them all in order?
Yeah, I could, but it would be a bit.
This is what the show is.
Doctor No.
Doctor No.
I could probably do it to a
point. From Russia with Love.
Yeah.
Goldfinger. Then Thunderball. Yes.
I think I could do it so far.
Then we have.
It was my thing in a pub quiz.
Oh, I'm probably going to get this wrong. Is it a Manchester Secret Service next? No, You Only Live Twice.
Yeah.
You Only Live Twice. Then, because Sean Connery had enough, then we had Magic Secret Service. Then Connery came back for Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah.
And then we had Roger Moore come in for
Live and Let Die.
Then
I think it's Man with a Golden Gun.
Then I think it was Man with a Golden Gun.
Which is such a great film. I love it in a way that it's not even like a James Bond film. I just would like, I would watch that.
I know a good story about the Man with a Golden Gun.
Go on then.
Sorry, I've interrupted.
I'm bored of the list.
Okay, well,
we're coming back to it.
Apparently, in the 90s, when Christopher Lee wasn't terribly popular, and he hadn't had his resurgence yet, he would go into one of like the sort of film memorabilia shops and often would sign things for them for money. And apparently, what happened once is someone said to him, "You don't have any like props or anything you could bring in, because we could give you good money for those." And apparently, Christopher Lee said, "Oh, well, actually, I've got the white shoes I wore in Man with the Golden Gun." They went, "That is perfect. That's amazing. If we'd give you a lot of money for those." And so he came back the next week with these white shoes. And he said, "Would you like me to sign them?" And he signed the white shoes, and they put them on display. And they gave him money for them. And as he left, they realised they were two left feet shoes. They'd obviously just bought them from Clark's or something. And then put them up for sale.
That's excellent. Christopher Lee is phenomenal. He managed to be a villain in three out of the four biggest film franchises of all time.
Yes, yeah.
So go on then, name them.
James Bond.
Yes.
Star Wars. Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. And
he didn't do Harry Potter. See, if only he'd been in Harry Potter.
He was also Dracula.
Yeah, and he was Dracula.
I saw an interview. I watched lots of Christopher Lee things. I saw an interview with him. Where
was it boring? It was a little bit.
Oh no! But that's partly what I like about them. And apparently, they said to them, "My agent was talking to the
producers." Oh, that's a good impersonation. I like it.
My agent was talking to the producers of Harry Potter, and they said, "Oh, we have a marvelous part here that he could play in Harry Potter." And they said, "Yes, well, he'd love to do it." And the producer of Harry Potter said, "No, because he's already played a wizard in The Lord of the Rings." And he goes, "I mean, that's what's wrong with filmmaking in this country."
He must have been fucking crazy.
He's furious.
Because there's that story about Bill Nighy, who was so desperate to be in Harry Potter that he just did like he got like 10 minutes of screen time. He was just like, "Everyone else is doing Harry Potter. Why aren't I?" He goes, "We haven't got any good parts left." He goes, "Well, I'll be that one then."
Well, Paul Whitehouse, he did a little part in one of them, the second or the third, as a knight, one of the sort of animated pictures that comes to life. It was cut from the film, but he's on the DVD extras,
right,
through which he made rather a large amount of money.
Wow. Oh, really?
Simply by being in the DVD extras.
Wow.
I wonder if that's the reason Bill Nighy might have been getting
it. Sure.
Really?
Sure.
Because I'll do that.
I got a feeling that there was a lot cut out of those first two Chris Columbus Harry Potter films. They didn't really feel like films in the way that the later ones. You haven't seen any of them.
Well, they very closely sort of followed the book, which actually in the end paid off because the fans didn't want changes. But the books, because they follow a year through his life, are quite episodic.
Sure.
They're not structured like a film narrative.
Sure.
They're more like a... They would have worked fantastically well as a classic BBC Sunday
evening tea time
show.
When they announced it as a film, I was kind of like, Harry Potter? Because it wasn't... They hadn't finished all the books by that point. It was, what, 2000s? And so I didn't realise it was a phenomenon at that time. And I was just like, well, if it's going to be 2.5 hours, why don't you just make it 3 hours and just do it in half-hour episodes? Like the Narnia book, you know, when they... Because it's Chronicles of Narnia, when that was on telly. And I just thought that made so much more sense. And then they were films, and you go...
That's why you're working for FUBAR Radio.
That's absolutely...
And you're not in Hollywood.
That's absolutely true. Well,
a lot of the producers in this country, if that happened in the United States, they would have said, well, he's played a wizard once, and he could do it again.
Have you heard his heavy metal work?
Oh, yes, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I know it. I know it's out there.
It's quite big. It's easy to listen to on Spotify, if anyone's interested.
But one of his last things that he did was he did... it was on the Hollywood Vampires album.
Oh, was it?
He does a poem at the beginning of the... I think it's at the beginning, or maybe it's at the end. I think he does a poem for Alice Cooper and Johnny Depp and Joe Perry on their album. Because they get everyone. They get, like, I say everyone. I think Paul McCartney's on the album.
Did Bill Nye make it? Bill I know Nye he wanted didn't. To be on it.
He wanted.
He was desperate to do it.
I think he plays a cowbell.
yeah, so that's one of the things he did. It was, yeah, there you go. That's my little...
I love Christopher Lee. I mean, I find him... I but also everything that's sort of quite... I like even that side of him. I think he's... And even though he does tell the same stories, I do like...
Well, you want him to be like he was, don't
you? He always just seems he's like an inch away from being furious about something. and he is, and I love it.
And you love The Wicker Man.
I love it. Absolutely love The Wicker Man.
I like The Wicker Man. But the last time I saw it was 10 years ago, and I watched it on a laptop in bed, and I fell asleep, and I was woken up by the screams of a man getting burnt alive, and it was very traumatic. It was a hot room as well.
Yeah, someone had put a hand with a hand candle by the side of your bed. That'd put you to sleep, probably.
It is a great film, though.
Yes, we've gone off pace, haven't we?
So,
Man with the Golden Gun.
So much to talk about in the world,
Man with the Golden Gun.
Man with the Golden
Spy Love Me
Gun. It probably did go Spy Love Me next.
Spy Love Me.
And then did it go to Moonraker? Yes, it did, because that was the return of Jaws.
Yes.
What has always happened with the Bond films is... Every time they reboot it, they go back to basics. They say, we want to do a proper Bond with a proper story, back to the basics of the character, strip it down. And they make a really good film, like Casino Royale was the last time. And then the next one, they think, we need to add a little bit more, add a little bit. And then they get bigger and bigger and sillier until you hit, like, Moonraker.
And then you've got to reboot it.
It happened with Pierce Brosnan. I'm quite a good friend of David Arnold, who he hasn't done the last couple of films, but he did the music for the Bond films for a long time. And he said he was scoring, I think it was the last Brosnan one, and I can't remember what they were called.
Die Another Day was
He said he was trying to write a piece of music where Bond is in an invisible car, having a car chase through a hotel made out of ice and shooting laser beams. Yeah. And he was just thinking, this isn't James Bond.
No. he also would do commission lots of bits of music. There's a Scott Walker song, which I think is from maybe World Is Not Enough, but I'm not sure. One of those ones. And it feels like, when you hear it, it feels like such a classic James Bond theme.
Well, it was the original theme for the movie, and then at the last minute they got garbage in there. What was that?
Yes.
I think. Oh, no, it was Sheryl Crow.
Right.
What was the one she
Tomorrow
did?
Tomorrow Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies.
Was it?
It was one of those ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they all slightly blur into
Tomorrow
each other, the
Brosnan. Never Dies.
It was like what happened with Thunderball, where originally John Barry wrote a theme called Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is the theme that's woven all the way through the film.
You had a movie show in the 90s,
right? I did.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
I did, yes.
We're going all over the place.
Research. But then at the last minute, the producer said, no, we want a proper Bond thing. And so he wrote a new song, which became Thunderball, that Tom Jones did. But if you listen to the film... The Kiss Kiss Bang Bang theme is the one that goes all the way through. And I think it's the same with the Scott Walker one.
I love that song. And it feels like...
That song is woven into it. But it's a great song, but it perhaps wasn't quite...
Contemporary.
Big and ballsy and...
Yeah, yeah.
ass kicking, and they do like to get, you know, the newest, hottest music acting.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Scott Walker wasn't in the 90s.
No. And but also in the 90s, he wasn't doing songs like that anymore. He was sort of hitting bits of meat and screaming. He was. And coming up now, we've got some got Scott Walker Ooh. Hitting some meat.
With a poem by Christopher Lee. were we still doing the list, or are we onto something else now?
Well, the list is quite helpful because we're spinning off, aren't
we? Okay, well, we got up to Moonraker, and then they stripped it right back down, and they made quite a good film. For Your Eyes Only.
For Your Eyes Only. Oh, yeah, but then there's...
Which was the first time we saw the singer actually sing the theme tune in the opening titles, yes, interestingly.
Who was it? It was
Sheena Easton. Prince's girlfriend.
And there's a Blondie song, isn't there, which is like another alternative For Your Eyes Only, I think.
Right, yeah. Yeah. There's loads of alternative James Bond songs, aren't there? Alice Cooper, The Man with the Golden Gun.
Apparently, Jack White, is he called Jack White? Yeah. No, I was confusing with Jack Black.
They're opposites.
He wrote Seven Nation Army as a Bond theme and sent it to them and said, look, I've written you a Bond theme.
That's an amazing song.
Yeah, would have been. But they didn't want to use it. But then when they came to do Quantum of Solace, they got him in to write something.
And did they use that one?
No, because that had been around for years.
But did they use...
They did a new one, right?
He did a new one with Alicia Keys, I think.
That's right.
It wasn't very good.
I can't remember it.
It felt slightly thrown together.
But there was another... But there was someone else that had done one, and they released it, and it was really good. And it was kind of like, why didn't you use that one? It wasn't Britney Spears, but it was a female singer... Who did a Bond thing that was really good. And
someone's written Another Way to Die. Is that someone?
Another Way to Die.
Oh, that was Jack White's Another Way to Die.
We've done that. We've literally just talked about that. Who was the woman that didn't get you?
I don't think it was a woman. It was recently.
So that was the Jack White one? Oh, you're talking about
It was for like the last film or the film before someone had written a theme.
This is the show, by the way. This is what we want.
This is exactly
what we want.
Well, your listener should be tweeting or something. Yeah.
They say it's exactly like just listening to your mates talk at the pub, and you go, "That's great," but don't they let you talk? Do you know what I mean?
And don't they have mates?
It's kind of like I would have left that pub, but. Because when we were doing pub quizzes, it was just kind of like, how many James Bond films are there? And or how many James Bonds... And you could divide them up by the actor. Mm. And I used to know it, but it was just like, you know, Sean Connery did 6, and George Lazenby did 1, and then Roger Moore did 7, and then Timothy Dalton did 2, and then Pierce Brosnan did 5?
5, I think.
Yeah, I think 5.
And Daniel Craig is on, and then you add them all up and you go, so that would be 23.
I think that's but that's obviously not including the unofficial Casino Royale.
And of course, Never Say Never Again. That's a good theme tune, I think. Never Say Never Again.
Never.
Do you not know it?
Never Say Never Again.
Never Say Never Again is a film where they were sort of like almost pastiching Bond, wasn't it? Where he starts off at a health spa and he throws urine in a person's face.
Well, that's that one where it has a joke. It's Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet wrote it, don't they?
And Rowan Atkinson.
Well, they added some gags at the last minute, yeah.
But they also used some of the gags that I've also seen in Porridge.
Yeah. they did recycle quite a lot.
but Rowan Atkinson turns up as who?
Is it Q, is it? Is he...
No, is he Q? No, he's a sort of... Isn't he sort of a... Or is he Q? Or is he a foreign ambassador?
I think he's Q.
Yeah.
But a young Q, and this was like early 80s as well, so it's a really young Rowan Atkinson before he was like a household name.
I knew him. Well, I knew his name.
You knew his name.
In our household, he was a name.
Yeah, sure. He'd done not the 9 o'clock news, but he'd done Blackadder by that point.
Yeah.
Maybe just about. By then.
There was a very, very, very long legal case about Thunderball.
Yeah.
Which I won't bore you with, because when they made Never Say Never Again, they were only allowed to make it if it followed exactly pretty much what had happened in the original script of Thunderball that had been written before the Thunderball film was made, which another producer called Kevin McClory owned. So it follows almost scene for scene Thunderball.
Because he had the rights to Thunderball, but he didn't have the rights to any other Bond.
Yeah, exactly.
And but that's also the reason why Blofeld is unnamed in one of the Bond films and he gets dropped down a chimney. You don't see his face.
Yeah, they wanted to kill him off so that nobody else could use him. So they wouldn't use him again, I think, because McClory owned Blofeld because that had been created for...
Yeah. Which film is that in?
It was one of the late Roger Moores, and one of the last two, maybe View to a Kill, the one before. Starts with him on a roof,
he hooks him on a helicopter, drops him down a chimney, and in the credits he's not even Blofeld.
Is it Blofeld's question mark it's or
like,
one of them?
No, it's like a bad guy bald in
man,
wheelchair,
bald man with scar.
it's something like that,
and mail jacket.
I saw Honor Majesty's Secret Service at Christmas and I loved it.
You've never seen it before?
No, I'd seen it. I mean, that's it. I feel like I see them all on telly, but they're also, a lot of them become, I think I get confused about which ones and what. But like, I watched it specifically to watch it and I loved it. I thought that was like,
it is one of the best Bond films. If it had had Sean Connery in, it would definitely have been the best of them all.
Yeah. It's terrific.
But it just doesn't quite pull it off.
All the time.
The funniest bit is all the stuff in the middle where he's best when he's impersonating the...
Yes.
Gosh, but that's not even his voice. He was redubbed for that, you see. That's why he was quite good.
Okay. But that, then it is, it's all really
But the line
funny,
at the end, which should be really moving, doesn't quite pull it off. It's a little bit toe-curling.
Sure. Oh, I don't know.
We have all the time in the world.
But then the song.
Song's great.
And then you go... Oh, that's a Bond... That's a Bond. Yeah. It was like... It's slightly different because they went... it was like a loophole or whatever, but you know, when you realise that Hard Day's Night and Help are soundtrack albums, you go, huh? They're not just albums, and they're kind of like, no, they're the soundtrack to the movies. And Welcome to My Nightmare is a soundtrack album because Alice Cooper wanted to break his contract with whoever he was with before, and he went off and did a soundtrack album with Warner Brothers.
But was there a film to go with it?
Yeah, there was a TV, it was sort of like a TV spectacular.
Oh, right.
1975 with Vincent Price in it.
Ah.
And
America's answer to Christopher Lee.
All the time in the world.
Christopher Lee.
That's Fan Club.
Yeah. So that is. So All the Time in the World was it was just for a Bond film, and you just like, that's crazy because it's such a
well-known song outside of Bond and everything. Yeah. And I think the song doesn't go,
he's got a powerful weapon.
And he's on a Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, right.
They don't do that. So I think that's why it can probably exist on its own, right? Because it hasn't got the name of the film.
Sure, but it's not about a man that's going around fucking women and shooting people.
But that music is woven all the way through the film. If you listen to it, there's sort of cocktail bar versions of it.
Oh, yeah. John Barry.
Yeah.
It's the least he could do, actually, is to come up with a theme for the film. You know, can't just recycle the Bond theme.
Because the opening theme obviously is an instrumental and a very good one at that.
It is good.
We should play a song.
Oh, it's your song.
It's
right?
Your song. What song would you choose?
I can't remember.
It's this, but I don't even know if I could present it. Adriano Celentano?
Yeah, I don't know how to say what it's called. Prison colon necessensial. It is. Now, I first heard this, they played a bit of it on QI.
Right.
And they tried to get people to identify what it was. And actually, I followed up, listened to it. It's actually a really good, quite funky song. It's done by this Italian guy. And it's, you know, like if you're a child and you're like, I'm going, or if you're Paul Whitehouse or one of his comedy shows, you say, I'm going to be an Italian. Go, hey, bitch, will you wear it? You make up gibberish. Well, this is an Italian doing like something that sounds like American, but actually isn't American. So it's an Italian doing it back to us.
Okay.
And it's actually quite a good song.
Okay, I'm going to play it.
Prison call in answer 92's all.
You the cold maze, say one. Prison call in answer 92's all. All right.
Color boss dying. Tails and behind me, get a cold. Bevis is staying at Little Joe. the color boss dies. Well, it's the same man, you can't be seen. You know, for some another judge, God believes it's a sham. You're the cover, not choose, not right, but not sure. Hope, hope, but just getting along the cover, not dying. Oh, but live as a stand, light the shoes, go, my man. You've a custom, the man's called the Raider Girls. Oh, for something.
On FUBAR Radio.
And we're back live at 1:46. So we're a minute out. Never mind. We're still in the studio with Charlie Higson. You like Sam Peckinpah?
I do, yes. Yes. Very much so.
But specifically The Wild Bunch?
I think The Wild Bunch is the greatest film ever made.
Do you?
Yes.
It is very good.
As a piece of cinema, it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on. I was going to say earlier this year I watched Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
That's what I was going to mention. Warren Oates is one of my favourite badasses from. He's great. I only knew him from Stripes for a long time.
Warren Oates was amazing.
Yeah.
And whatever he was in.
When I started going through the fucking Sam Peckinpah. But when I started watching all the Sam Peckinpah films, yeah, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is great. But he's also.
Well, someone described that film as the worst made great film.
What, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo?
It's all over the place. So off his tits when he was making it.
Sure, right.
It's largely incoherent, but there's something majestic about it. And Warren Oates in his white suit grubbier glasses. As it goes on.
Talking to heads in bags.
Yeah,
it's great.
I love it. It makes very little sense.
But he's great in The Wild Bunch as well. He's got a wicked moustache in The Wild Bunch. The moustache does a lot of work.
It's just
brilliant.
And, you know, it's a film about old people as well.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which you don't really see so much.
I was just thinking...
And their faces on screen are just amazing.
And it's about the end of an era, isn't it? It's about the end of the Western movie era as well. It's kind of like coming into... It's like
and it's a transition between... Yeah, because, you know, I mean, when I was growing up in the 60s, the sort of default mode for American entertainment, film and TV was westerns.
Sure.
There were tons of western shows on TV, like Bonanza and High Chaparral and The Virginian and all these things, which are, and western films, millions of them made. And then sort of in the 70s, they sort of started to die out, and basically the sort of thriller, the action thriller, took over, and the sort of cop show, which is now, which is what everything is.
Yeah.
And The Wild Bunch is in some ways a sort of transition between those two things, because it's sort of set, I think, just before the First World War. And they've got these sort of, it starts with The Wild Bunch, the gang, they're impersonating American soldiers, so they've got the automatic Colt pistols, they haven't got revolvers. They've got now the sort of pistol that everyone uses,
right, okay,
in an action film. It's the sort of the square one with the cartridge that you push into the handle.
Right.
And yeah, it was a transition between, you know, in westerns people would always get shot, but there was never any sort of explicit blood. But then what happened was the western sort of got exported to, first of all, Kurosawa started doing his samurai movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they came back to Italy, which got remade as the sort of early Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, which were much more violent than the American ones.
Well, it's
cynical.
It's like that song that you just played. It's it's American sensibilities filtered through. No, it's an American genre that's filtered through Italian sensibilities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
they're also totally postmodern movies, aren't they? They are those things where they go, this is them doing, but this is what they'd really be like, or this is how we'd do them if we made them.
They don't make a lot of sense. It's all just about the moment and the set piece.
Spaghetti
and the
westerns. Yeah. Well, it's just like, let's get Henry Fonda in to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
And the first thing he does is kill a kid. And you go, what? And Henry Fonda is just like, the story of that was, that was Once Upon a Time in the West. And, the story of that is Henry Fonda sort of like, he put contact lenses in and he sort of like dyed his beard different colour and kind of turned up on set, and so Sergio Leone was just like, no, you've got to look like Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
Because what we're going to do is you're going to walk in, you're going to kill a kid, and then you're going to see you from behind, you're going to shoot a kid, and then the camera's going to turn around and you're going to see your blue eyes, and everyone's going to go, no, Henry Fonda. And I love the fact that it was kind of like that cast, it was casting that was only based on the fact that Henry Fonda had all of that baggage with him, and they were making him do something completely different.
And then Wild Bunch sort of reclaimed all that back for America and kicked off the whole sort of modern violent crime thriller.
It's like that game where you draw a head and then someone else draws the body. It's kind of like, it was like a back and forth where it's like, okay, it's been over to Italy and it's coming back to America.
Do you know what you call those?
It's called
an exquisite corpse.
That's what it's called.
Really?
Exquisite corpse.
Nice little.
But you see, the spaghetti westerns didn't ever really make a lot of sense, and you never believed in any of those people as actual characters. But the great thing about the Wild Bunch is that they're real people. They've got a real. There's almost a documentary feel to quite a lot of it, of just the gang, just, or what's left of the gangs, are hanging out with each other and just being blokes.
It is funny that you say, when you think, oh, it is just old people, you think, yeah, because actually, weirdly, I do almost, there's a little bit of Dad's Army about it. There's a little bit of, like, of that in it as well. And it is, it feels like, I watched Unforgiven this week, and I haven't seen it for years and years. And that's another thing where it's like an old cowboy, and it made me think that Unforgiven feels like one of those movies. It was such a huge thing at the time, and it feels like in the public consciousness, gone away a bit. And yet you think, like, the influence that film's had on everything since.
Unforgiven?
Do
you think?
I think it's you think, like, but even stuff like, you know, a film like Logan that came out, you go, well, that's basically Unforgiven.
What do you think?
It's just that it's the plot of Unforgiven put in a sort of superhero context, isn't it?
Sure.
It's the old sort of warrior, who comes
back for one last job.
He has to come back for one last job, and you think, oh, it's just Unforgiven, isn't it? And you just think all these proto-Western things, and I guess even Tombstone again, that's Fan Club, is probably something that's coming out of Unforgiven.
Well, it's interesting. They keep trying to bring the Western back these days, but none of them have worked.
Well, Open Range. Did you see Open Range?
No.
Oh, that was great. And
it might have been a good film, but it didn't bring back.
No, sure.
They did Magnificent Seven recently, didn't they? Tried to sort of.
Yeah, but that was shit.
That can be a problem if you're trying to redo
but
things.
In terms of modern westerns, Open Range was a really great film, and it was kind of Kevin Costner coming back and doing a western, And he wasn't the lead. It was Robert Duvall was the lead. And he was kind of like the co-star.
But Old Men Again.
Yeah, but it didn't relaunch as a Western. You're quite right.
No. But I guess the nice thing about the Wild Bunch is it's sort of an old man end of the Western at the time when it is actually the end where they sort of realise that they're not making these anymore.
I do believe I
and
made that
And he'd made
point.
Load of Westerns before
I,
that.
I believe I made that point about 4 minutes ago, Nat.
Yeah, but we're clarifying it.
We're clarifying the point.
And he'd actually started.
Just don't like this relationship that we've got going at the moment.
He'd started by making Westerns on TV. TV Westerns. Then he got into movies, made a few movie Westerns. And then after The Wild Bunch, he pretty much concentrated on thrillers.
I've never got all the way through Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
It's pretty good.
With Kris Kristofferson.
It's got its moments.
And what's his name? Kris Kristofferson and he plays James Coburn.
James Coburn.
Oh, yeah.
James Coburn. Wow. He's great.
Yes, he was very, very cool.
When he turns up in Young Guns 2 and you go, ah, oh, that's how you do it.
Yeah. He's got a lovely set of Nashes as well, isn't he, James Coburn?
Yeah. Mm. What's that? Oh, I can't remember. There's a Nick Nolte film that he plays his dad.
James Coburn plays Nick Nolte's dad.
Paul Schrader film. I can't remember what it's called.
Both Nashes. Good Nashes casting.
Nolte and Coburn. I mean, it's a Nash off.
That's
I enjoyed it too much.
No, it's good.
Pam Seconpa.
She was a very good director.
The Wild Bunch, The Ballad of Cable Hogue, Straw Dogs, Junior Bonner, The Getaway, Pat Garrett and Billy the King, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia,
Killer Elite,
Cross of Eye, a film about how awful the war is from the Germans' point of view. I mean, you just like go, that's like such a bold move, isn't it? Where all of the heroes in the film were Nazis or German soldiers. They're not Nazis, they're German soldiers. But it's kind of like, that's a controversial kind of thing to make in 1977.
Convoy, God, I didn't know that was Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, he was slumming it a bit there.
Yeah.
No, that's one
Ride
of those
the High
films.
Country, one of his early ones. That's a fantastic film.
Convoy is one of those FOP purchases, which is still in the cellophane next to my bed 8 months later from buying it. But,
The Osterman Weekend sounds a bit like a sort of Richard Brier sitcom. Sounds like something quite
that's
nice is happening.
Sort of turgid spy things.
We've got 5 minutes left.
Oh, should we do the game?
Should we do the game?
We're going to play a game, okay.
Okay, this is the game. It's called Better or Worse. And in this game, you just have to say whether the person afterwards is better or worse than the person before it. So you're starting off with Alan Sugar.
Yeah.
Is Gino De Campo better or worse than Alan Sugar?
That's a hard one to start with.
Gino De Campo better or worse than Alan Sugar?
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to say better.
Gino De Campo is better than Alan Sugar.
I'm going to say worse.
Your opinion doesn't matter, Charlie.
Oh, sorry, it's all based on my own opinions.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
But
have I got to try and guess what you've said?
Yes.
It's normally fairly common sense, but... Right.
Put a Pauline Quirk, better or worse than Gino De Campo?
Well, obviously better.
Better, much better. Yeah.
Better.
Much better.
She's got her own school.
I like Pauline Quirk. Nick Berry, better or worse than Pauline Quirk?
Worse.
Is Danny DeVito better or worse than Nick Berry?
Well, he's better.
You're actually making him angry. Better.
Is Gary Barlow better or worse than Danny DeVito?
Far worse.
far worse.
Is Dusty Springfield better or worse than Gary Barlow?
Better.
I'll say better.
Better, better.
I'm sorry, I thought we were still on Danny DeVito.
Is Prince Harry better or worse than Dusty Springfield?
Worse.
Well, I think you'll have said worse.
Worse. Is Prince Nassim better or worse than Prince Harry?
I'd say better.
And is Prince better or worse than Prince Nassim?
Oh, far worse.
Far worse?
Oh, yeah.
Prince
Nassim's a far better singer and
I'm afraid Prince is better.
Oh,
Prince
really?
Better.
Oh, Prince the... Yes.
Yeah, Prince.
Not the dog.
No.
Seven.
Got seven. That's pretty good.
That's not bad. Who got 10?
Last week, John Niven.
John Niven got 10.
Nailed it.
But if he hadn't got 10, you would have been...
Well, if I'd realised that it was like a sort of Top Gear leaderboard thing, I'd have tried a bit harder.
Sure.
Well, it is like that.
Yeah, but you can't live your life like that, can you?
You can't live your life in the past.
You got 7.
Rewind.
Before then, I don't think we've ever had a 9, but before then we've had an 8. We've had several 8s.
Interesting.
Oh, it's not, though, is it? I mean, it's barely a conversation, let alone why are we broadcasting it? Fucking hell. And your favourite show is The Prisoner. That was my favourite show.
We've got another 4 minutes.
We've got 1 minute, right? I loved The Prisoner so much that there was a girl that I, not fancied, but I loved her at school, and she was a really good friend of mine, and I taped every episode of The Prisoner for her. And made it into a box set.
Oh, that's lovely.
Did you ever watch them?
Who knows? But on the spine, I drew his eyebrows.
Oh, that's nice.
What, so that you had to keep them set all together?
Yeah, yeah. I made a box
set
for
him. Like the Mr. Men.
Yeah. And I drew sort of like his eyes and his eyebrows.
So a box set of VHSs? Was it like sort of 10 foot wide?
It was 1997. No, I got it all on three 4-hour tapes.
Oh, okay.
I think I may have used time stretching.
Oh, the LP? Long play?
Yeah, maybe I used long play.
See, I watched it first time around in the 60s, being that much younger than you.
Sure. Okay.
But yes, I do remember in the 70s I was at university and they repeated them and everyone was watching it again.
Yes. It held up. And it was the Secrets of Danger Man, wasn't it? The unofficial Secrets of Danger Man, where... and then also it was one of the instances where he knew that they weren't going to get another series, so that by the end of the Prisoner it went absolutely fucking bug nuts crazy. Yeah. Anyway, that's all we've got time for. Completely. Thank you for coming
and
in,
your
Charlie
book
Hickson.
Is called
Gates of Death.
Gates of Death, Final Fantasy, in shops now.
Fighting Fantasy.
Fighting Fantasy. Fighting Fantasy.
Fighting Fantasy. Good night.